Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today, we re-air remarks from a compelling panel discussion at Concordia College that featured former North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp and former North Dakota Governor Ed Schaefer. The event, titled With Malice Towards None, took place on April 3rd and explored how personal convictions and faith shape leadership in public service. We'll begin by airing significant portions of the Q&A session from that evening, providing a closer look at how these two leaders maintain their integrity and uphold principal commitments amid the complexities of political life. Join with us as they uncover their personal reflections and discuss their wider impact on political conduct and leadership. The discussion was moderated by Dr. Nicholas Howard, Assistant Professor of Political Science, and Dr. Sonia Wendling, Dean of the School of Arts and Sciences, who posted the initial question about the moral compasses guiding Senator Heitkamp and Governor Schaefer.
Both of you were talking about good people needing to stand up. And Governor, you were talking about that you need to stay true to yourself. My question is somewhat of a personal nature. What informs your moral compass, your goodness? What has kept you on the good side to fight for the good people?
That's a great question, because I think it's one of the most important element of performance is knowing who you are, what you believe, what you stand for. Because as Governor Link told me, it's so easy to get pushed off by a poll or whatever. If you don't know what you stand for, if you don't know what you believe in, it's very difficult to walk a straight line and get it done. For me, I'm a Christian, I'm a follower of Jesus, and my moral compass and character comes from the Bible and the truths of the Bible. And I relate that to what I believe in and how, when I'm faced with a situation, when I have to make a decision, when I have to listen to somebody that disagrees or whatever, you know, I go back to the love and the compassion of Jesus, and that's what keeps me in the straight line.
I think it's interesting because I once did Girl State, and a young woman asked me during the program, she said, "You're Catholic, you were raised Catholic." I said, "Yes." "How do you square your political beliefs with your religion?" And I thought it was kind of a brash question, actually. And I said to her, I said, "I think I am who I am because of my religion. I was raised with a sense of service and commitment to each other." You know, when you look at kind of the tradition that you're raised in, the religious tradition that you're raised in, I think for me, it definitely informed my priorities and what I cared about. And I think when you're a politician and there is always a shortcut, trust me, there's always the easy way out of making a decision, especially if you're in the legislative branch. It's a little harder to hide the decision when you're an executive, but if you're in the legislative branch, you can always lay low and just go with the flow, right? And no one's gonna know who you are or what you've done. The bottom line is the votes that you take may not be the ones that you, the public, understand, but they are the ones that challenge you to live your faith, to live your ideals, to live your values against a big headwind of the people don't want you to do it. I would say the votes I'm proudest of are the ones that I felt took a principled position against a big headwind. The votes I'm least proud of are the ones where I copped out, where I took a dodge, where I took a fall, just so I didn't have to confront the tough decisions. You know, I said this morning on a radio show, I am not Saint Heidi. I've not done everything right. But I think at the end of the day, the most important thing that you can do, if you have made, and you know, by the way, you know when you've made one of those decisions because you don't feel very good about it. The thing that you can do in the spirit of Jesus, I think, is to step back and say, I did not do what I needed to do today. I will do better tomorrow. And we can all grow from the mistakes that we make, from the decisions that we didn't make, or the decisions that we made that were done for selfish purposes and not for purposes of advancing society in the long run.
I'm curious, for both of you having different backgrounds politically in terms of what offices you served in and how you got there, kind of, when you think about the world, what does it mean for a politician to serve and live in this increasingly polarized world we live in?
That was the second part.
I'll get there.
Do what every good politician does. Answer the question you wanted asked.
It was broad. It was broad for a reason.
I even forgot the question.
So what does it mean for a politician to live kind of in this polarized world?
You look at the people who have stood against the wave, stood for principles, and, obviously you're all going to know who I'm talking about. People like Liz Cheney, that I would not have agreed with Liz Cheney in any way, shape, or form, but I believe she's a true patriot. Mitt Romney. But I want to mention a friend of mine, James Lankford. James Lankford and I are about as polar opposite. Other than having red hair, we have nothing in common. But we served, I was ranking member or committee chair, I can't remember which. I think it was one year I was chair and he was ranking, and the next it was reversed. But we did a lot of work together, and we built that mutual respect and a friendship. That was kind of really odd, given kind of where we came from. But I watched him stand in the void. And I think found his voice. And I thought, it doesn't matter whether you agree with what James did or not, whether you agreed. And you all know James Lankford was part of the chief negotiator on the immigration reform bill that was never taken up in the Senate. An unlikely hero standing in the void, a profile in courage. And so it used to be that you were in the political limelight and get accolades for being the compromiser, for being somebody who would put the tough work in, come up with a result that may not be perfect. And now to be that person is the greatest risky place in politics. To be a compromiser is the greatest risky place in politics. And that makes this era of our political discourse that much harder, because you are not going to get anything done unless you're willing to compromise.
I'm not a compromiser. How is it to work in the political system today? I love it. First of all, I'm a debater. I like talking to people with difference of opinion. I like gathering a lot of different, some people are a little weird out there these days, but I have this thing in me about, I want to wade into the conflict because I want to solve the conflict. Which is kind of dumb sometimes, because you can't solve the conflict. I really enjoy it. And one of the reasons I enjoy it is because I've been blessed to be held in good stead in the state of North Dakota. So 25 years after we're out of office, people are still saying, you did a good job. What do you think about this? Takes us longer to go grocery shopping these days because everybody wants to talk about it. I think the important thing is going back to performance. When you've done well, when people appreciate what you were able to accomplish, and maybe they even embellish it over time and think I did a better job than I did. The point is, I'm a people person. Politics is a people business. I love the interaction. And I actually enjoy getting yelled at once in a while. Not at home, but, in the grocery store. I do appreciate that conflict, because I really think, that the more that people are willing to stand up and express their views in their direction, the better off, the better policy, the better direction that we're going to get, because you somehow, some way, incorporate what they say in what you do. And it may not be recognizable, it may not be, hey, so-and-so told me that I should do this, but, you gather that information, and the more information, the more feeling you get from people, the more you understand that there is difficulty and angst and people are angry and difficult, but the more you can absorb that, the better job you're going to be able to do moving forward.
So ask for story time a little bit from each of you on your answers to the first part. What is a specific example in your careers of reaching across the divide of actually working towards solving these problems in your specific examples?
Interestingly, one of the comments or interactions we had with the students today asked a similar question about, or I guess when we were talking to the faculty, is how do you change your mind? or, you know, is an institution here, education and learning that allows me to change my mind, you know, to gather the information. One of the things I was talking about was there was a time when there was a difficult policy decision on the table. I think it was Heidi, I'm not sure, but, you know, we had to, you know, go into this meeting with a plan, with what we wanted the outcome to be. The staff was all tuned up, we had all the notes, everything was there. And during this time of the meeting, I changed my mind, because what was being said, the other side, the other thing that was going on, it was that, again, that experience with the staff, you know, was like, what are you doing? But, you know, really it was that drawing of the information that said, okay, you know, maybe that is the best way to go. And again, it's the focus on not your political philosophy or your direction, but it's like, what's best for the people here? There was a time when I vetoed a piece of legislation. It became apparent afterward that was probably the wrong decision. And I actually wrote a letter to the legislators and said, override my veto, you know. You have to be willing out there to, you know, accept that information and do what's right. It was one of the tenets in our office was do the right thing, and we tried to do that as much as we could.
We are listening to excerpts from With Malice Towards None, a panel discussion held at Concordia College with former North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp and former Governor Ed Schaefer. The event was held on April 3rd.
And I think my whole history in the Senate is one of working across the aisle. You couldn't get anything done. Senate's a place where you need 60 votes. And if you're not crossing over to try and get somebody to agree with you, to work with you, you really aren't getting it done. But I think some of the things that you do that people don't see or never result in legislation. People always say, well, what's the one thing you could tell me about your work? Well, I'm a big believer that a lot of challenges families have and individuals have is related to adverse childhood experiences and childhood trauma. If you've studied childhood trauma, you know if you have four or more adverse childhood experiences, there's 10. But if your score is 4, your life expectancy is 20 years less than anyone else in the country. These are indicators that tell us whether you're going to have mental health challenges, whether you're going to have addiction challenges. And so I came to the Senate wanting to find solutions to problems, not just, you know, treat the symptoms, but what are the root causes of the challenges that people have and families have, particularly children. And I knew that if I started preaching adverse childhood experiences and childhood trauma, everybody'd go, yeah, yeah, whatever. And so what we did in my office is we put together a series of interventions and seminars, starting with staff, bringing in staff members, and we started, and maybe there were 30 people at the first one. By the time we finished bringing experts talking about this, we had over 150 staff people in the room, because word of mouth spread that this is pretty interesting stuff. Today, in legislation, it's not going to have my name on it, but pretty much every piece of mental health legislation, every piece of education legislation will have a component that deals with childhood trauma. Okay, what does that mean? It means we'll never know whether we'll see healthier children or whether we'll have better interventions. But it does mean that you can have an impact that goes beyond just one piece of legislation, one farm bill, one, you know, banking bill that opens up community bankers to more opportunities. I go through all that. But if you said, what's the one thing that I think, if I had to say, might have a lasting impact with absolutely no attribution ever for me, it's the work that we did on adverse childhood experiences and childhood trauma, because I think it's critical.
Compromise can bring good
but
things
that's
about.
That's not a compromise. Isn't that what you said?
just to follow up on that.
Yeah, he's been out of politics longer than I have.
But here's my point. I don't think that you have to compromise to craft good public policy. And we always say you have to compromise. You have to do it. You know, after my first legislative session, in the signy die party, which is what everybody, you know, claps when it's all over, Republican legislators came up to me and said, you don't compromise on anything. I said, I compromise for not my values. I don't have to give up my values to understand what's best for the people. And so I'm willing to incorporate what's best for the people. I don't have to compromise my values, what I believe, what I care about. I don't have to give that up. But I can craft policy that is beneficial for the common good. And I think that makes a difference. And so it always bugs me if people say, well, you have to compromise. You don't. People say you have to be a moderate Republican.
Spoken like a governor.
Well, then let's not use the word compromise. But you do have to work together,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
To get things done. So what advice would you give our younger generation that maybe is interested, wants to go into politics, wants to do good? Should they stick to their principles? Should they compromise? What are your sort of recommendations, your guiding thoughts? What would you tell them?
I don't think when we talk about compromise, we talk about compromising principles or values. There's some things that you shouldn't compromise, you know, and you've got to know that as a politician. But the problem with politics today, and as a human being who has to look in the mirror in the morning after you take one of these votes, what I would say is, in America, we have let perfect be the enemy of good. By that I mean, we want what we want, and we want it the way we want it, and if it's not that way, I'm not going to do it. I wanted to do a bill that dealt with improving border security on the northern border. Everybody agreed with it. It was supposed to go through unanimous consent, and one person said, I'm not going to let that go, because one person can freeze you out from unanimous consent, and I'm not going to go with that because I want something for the southern border. I'm saying, I just want to do this one thing that's going to get us more border openings and more border patrol on the northern border, and everybody agrees that we need it. Perfect is the enemy of good. And if we're ever going to move policy along, I would tell young people, understand your values. Yes, be true, like Ed said, to who you are as a person, and know that if you do something that makes you feel internally bad, is probably you're compromising a core value. But you aren't going to get the whole loaf. That's not the way the world works. Certainly not the way legislation works. And so find those victories, because incrementally things can improve. And if you aren't willing to do incremental improvement, we're going to stall out the way we've been stalling out in Washington right now.
Advice to young people today is really to understand that our system is great, that our system works. And while it's difficult sometimes and man, it gets nasty, and there's a lot of pushback or whatever. You know, we have a political system in the United States of America that is solid, it's good, it's resilient, and it survives. And we have elections and they change, and everybody thinks, oh, I'm so important, I'm gonna change the world when I get elected, and then they don't do it. But you know what? Our system survives. We often, and especially students and young people today, you know, think it's all about me, it's so important, I have to get in there, I have to get it done, I have to have my voice be heard. And when you do that, I think you really get to the point of saying, like I said, it's all about me and not about the people. So my advice is always take the stance that you have to represent all the people all the time. If you're gonna serve, you need to serve people, not the government, not your own political party. You need to serve the people. In doing that, when we talk to campus leaders here today, they're involved, there are various factions on the campus, there are other people, and Heidi's advice was, hey, go stand next to them. The people you disagree with, the people you don't understand, be there, engage, learn from them. But here's the reality, they have their opinion, they arrive there through study, through education, through prayer, and it's real and right for them. It might be different than yours, but that doesn't make it wrong. And we need to have that understanding between people to make the system work.
We're starting to learn who the candidates are for the 2024 election. For the presidential race, we know now. And we're starting to learn, we're going to learn soon, for the North Dakota gubernatorial race, for the House race to replace the aspiring gubernatorial candidate in Kelly Armstrong and other races. I'm curious how you see kind of the, I'm going to say stakes, because I can't come up with a better word, of this election. It doesn't have to be presidential, it can be congressional, it can be state level. Essentially, kind of how do you see this race in isolation for the stakes of it and kind of the history leading to this?
You know, in the governor's race specifically, what I'm interested in the governor's race and what the results are is I'm interested in both candidates saying, this is how I'm going to govern. And let me give you an example. Both are Republican gubernatorial candidates in North Dakota. Both of them, when they made the announcement, said, I'm going to follow along with Governor Burgum's effort to eliminate the income tax. So as I've been interacting and talking to both candidates, you know, my question is, what's your tax policy? What's best for the people of North Dakota? I want to know how you're going to govern. And if you're going to walk into that governor's office with a preconceived notion of what you're going to do already, you can't represent the people. The example that I talk to them about is when you say you're going to lower or you're going to eliminate the income tax in North Dakota. I go, okay, so 60% of the people in North Dakota don't pay income tax. The high-level earners pay income tax. You know, eliminating the income tax sounds good to Wall Street and billionaires and things like that. But what about the people? Now, if you're going to have tax policy for the people, and by the way, tax policy isn't revenue. By the way, tax policy is behavior. And if you're going to have tax policy for the people, maybe eliminate sales tax on clothing, you know, or something like that that benefits everybody in the state instead of a little bit. And I think that's the difference when you get in the chair of governor. You're representing all the people all the time, and you got to have that different perspective of being able to absorb what people are needing and looking for and wanting in their government and reacting to that and developing public policy to do that. So that's what I'm looking for in the governor's race.
The unfortunate thing is that this is not going to be a campaign of inspiration. My hopes and my dreams is that we are inspired to vote for someone. And what you're going to hear, I don't care if it's Democrat or Republican, what you're going to hear is be very afraid of the other person. The other person's really a bad person. The other person will do really bad things. And that is going up and down the ballot. And you see it right now in the governor's race, right? I mean, there isn't any policy difference, so I don't know what all of the negative ads are. Just seems to me like that kind of fear or that kind of negative stuff is even infiltrating in a primary race in North Dakota in the dominant Republican Party. And so what I would say is that if you're looking for an inspiring, uplifting, boy, am I excited about America Democracy 2024, you should maybe go to sleep because it's not going to happen. And so the question becomes, in this cycle, do we just let that wash over us and say, we're going to try and be better?
After the break, we'll hear more from Senator Heitkamp and Governor Schaefer.
Hello, everyone. It's Thomas Jefferson, the third president of the United States, urging you to listen every Sunday at 11 a.m. Central to Clay Jenkinson's new program, Listening to America. I'll still be making regular appearances, of course, but this whippersnapper Jenkinson is now planning to travel around the country in search of its soul on the eve of the 250th birthday of the United States. So let's see what he has to say. Don't go away and tell your friends. It'll be Listening to America every Sunday at 11 a.m. Central on Prairie Public.
Welcome back to Main Street. We continue the conversation from an event that was held at Concordia College titled With Malice Towards None. It took place on April 3rd and explored how personal convictions and faith shape leadership in public service that not only bridge political divides, but also inspire civility and collaboration for the common good. Speaking were former North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp and former Governor Ed Schaefer, one a Democrat and one a Republican, and both of whom have a rich history of public service to our state and a history of working across the aisle on common issues. We now jump back to the beginning of the event that demonstrated that elected representatives with political differences can still work together.
Dean Sonia Wedling of the School of Arts and Sciences at Concordia College opened the evening with a warm welcome, highlighting the careers of Heitkamp and Schaefer, both of whom have exemplified the spirit of bipartisan cooperation. Heitkamp's efforts towards improving the lives of Indigenous people, working families, and securing affordable health care, along with Schaefer's work in diversifying North Dakota's economy and promoting agriculture, set the backdrop for a rich discussion on civility and the common good. Senator Heitkamp takes the podium first, stressing the importance of showing students and the community that a friendly, productive political relationship across party lines is not only possible, but essential. She reflects on her own surprise election as North Dakota's first female senator, attributing her success to her focus on the people over party lines. Heitkamp passionately talks about the challenges of political tribalism and the need for civic engagement to counteract the divisiveness plaguing American politics.
Thank you all for this warm welcome. When people ask me, why are you doing this? Why did you come? I said, because so many students on campuses like this have never seen a legitimate, honest, and friendly political relationship across the aisle. The only thing that they have seen in their history has been a lot of rancor, a lot of disagreement, and a lot of mean-spirited back and forth. And so I thought it's just so important that we remind ourselves as the adults in the room that things don't have to be this way, that things can in fact change because they change so rapidly from, you know, even the time when Ed and I were in office, you know, I guess now it's 20 years ago, 24 years ago, Ed. But the example that I give about where we are is how North Dakota has changed. I tell people, when I was elected to the United States Senate, no one thought I was going to get elected. I kind of thought I had a shot, but for full disclosure, I was pretty shocked on election night that I might have won. The forum didn't predict it, right, Jack? You kind of missed that one. But I can't resist. I saw you there. I couldn't resist. You should have sat further back, and then it would have been too dark. The lights would have been in my eye. But I tell you this story because when I ran, the reason why national pundits didn't think I could get elected is because they knew Barack Obama was going to lose the state by at least 22 points. If he could win by something less than that, they thought maybe I had a shot. But 22 points, that was just too big of a partisan political headwind. Well, Barack Obama lost North Dakota by 22 points, and I won election to the United States Senate. So at that point in time, people were looking at electing or voting for the person. Elect not for a political party, not for a slogan, but actually voting for the person. When I ran for re-election 6 years later, and these are important 6 years politically, that number was 4. And Donald Trump won North Dakota by a percentage higher than any other state in the union except 3 in North Dakota. And so it was clear that something had happened to tribalize our politics. And it made it less, politically available to work across the aisle, to be compromisers, to actually do the work of governing. We were in that spot where it didn't matter if you produced 2 farm bills or if you did opened up oil exports or whatever it was that we wanted to brag about that we had done during that time period. None of that mattered. What mattered is whether you belonged to the right tribe and whether you were flying the colors and being loyal. And so we I mean, I'm saying it's wrong to vote your political party. That's not wrong. But it also has created a dynamic in this country that has left, in some degree, the people behind. Because the people we go to represent as public officials are the people who are the loudest, the maybe most extreme of our political discussion. And it has driven the narrative. It has made it okay to say really mean things. And if you get that viral moment that you can then fundraise off, it becomes even a competition to see who can get the most numbers of clicks or who can get the most amount of attention on social media. And it has denigrated our political discourse. And we now are at a spot where, how do we fix this? Because right now in America, if you ask people, are they satisfied with the state of the politics in this country, 70% of the people are disgusted by what's going on and feel powerless to change it. And the only way it can change is by broad civic engagement, by good people stepping up. We talked all day, Ed and I did, about, you know, what are the solutions to this problem? How do we fix this problem? And what we've been saying over and over and over again is, as the mean, loud voices get louder, the good people are retreating. The good people are saying, I don't want to be part of that. I only have so much bandwidth in my life. I'm raising my kids. I'm helping with my grandkids. I'm trying to put food on the table. I'm trying to do all the things that we all need to do. And I don't have time if it's not going to have value, if it's not going to change anything. And so one of the reasons why we do these programs is to encourage people not to step back, but to step up. To begin that process of engaging, yes, social media, a cesspool of meanness, right? But what happens when 20 people get on the same social media platform and say something nice or say something that clarifies points of view? What happens if you become truth tellers on social media? A lot of times those loud voices retreat. They don't want to be challenged in a way where they look foolish. And so we are doing this program, and if you had told me 5 years ago that I'd be affiliated with an academic institution, I would have said that's the last thing I want to do with my time. But I chose that as a kind of second career because I believe that it is so important that we model behaviors, that we encourage critical thinking, but we also encourage civil discourse and dialogue among young people, wherever we can find it, wherever young people are gathered, to model those behaviors. Because if we don't, if all young people and students at institutions like this see is the rancor and the anger and the meanness, they're not only going to step back, they are going to run back. And so, you know, I tell people I am the daughter of someone who was part of the greatest generation. And the greatest generation took on the greatest challenge ever seen in the history of the world. The Nazis, the Axis, the Japanese, the autocrats who would take over the world with horrible, horrible intentions and ideas. But yet we band together in this country and across the world, good people of good intentions, to fight back. We are so good in this country defeating external threats. The last time we were unified in this country was after 9/11, because that was a threat on all of us, because we found our common American identity. We found our common American purpose. It is so much harder to find that common American purpose when the threat in our democracy is ourselves. It's internal. It is, what do we do about where we are today? How do we, and it's not them versus us, it's us versus us. And how do we reach across the aisle? How do we have that civil discourse that will lead to a more perfect union? The divisions in this country have been fanned by bad politics. Because what motivates people more than fear? Fear of the other. Fear of the guy next door, fear of the person coming to this country who just wants to have a better life because they may look different from you. Fear motivates our politics and it sells. It's so much easier than inspiration. How do you fix that? Don't vote for fear. Vote for people who inspire you, who have the best ideas. And you may say, where do I find them? Because I've looked up and down that ballot and I haven't found anybody who has inspired me. We need to make sure that we're not just voting in those general elections, but we are voting and stepping up. And guess what? Someone in this room could be the next inspirational leader. Someone in this room could move our country forward. A young person could be the next governor of North Dakota with the idea of bringing people together and not dividing people. We, the people, are the only people who are going to fix this. Do not look to Washington. Really? Would anyone look to Washington for solutions? The solutions are in communities like this. They're in campuses across the country. They're in your own backyard. We talked to students today, and they said, well, how can we participate? And I said, start by talking to each other. Start by building the skill of dialogue and conversation and communication, and don't be afraid to take on the tough issues. It helps you build character, it helps you build critical thinking, and it helps you build the skills that you'll need to be good at whatever you decide to do, whether it's politics or whether it is religion. You have to have the ability to talk to people and listen to people.
Governor Schaefer next shares his journey, humorously noting his series of former titles, but emphasizing the serious need for civility in political engagement. He recalls lessons learned from his political career, the importance of staying true to oneself, and the need to focus on the good of the people over party politics. Schaefer's story of bipartisan cooperation, exemplified by Senators Dole and McGovern, serves as a powerful reminder of the potential for unity in service of a greater cause.
Really, it's always a fun opportunity to be with Heidi, have a little political discourse, have some friendship, and share some good memories. So thanks for the opportunity to get together. Sonia, you mentioned that I'm a former president and a former secretary and a former governor. It's kind of like I couldn't hold a job, right? I actually have a grandson that calls me former. As we kind of set up this conversation about civility in the willingness to engage in the public process, I thought I'd give you a couple of examples or a couple of things that were messages to me or learning experiences for me in how to kind of navigate that really difficult situation of the badness of politics. Is that a word? The unfortunate anger and difficulty and challenge and fighting in the political party. And one of the things that I learned is when I got in office is there's a big difference between getting elected, which is politics, and moving to the politics of performance, which is after you're there. And one of the things that worked well for Heidi and myself is when our political party, we weren't running for the same office at the same time, but our political parties were certainly engaged in a negative way with each other, pounding on each other. We didn't know about it in 92 because we didn't have the social media out there. But it was, you know, it was a difficult, ugly time. And what happened is that when we came together and were elected, the focus shifted not for the political party or who brought you here or what they did, but it shifted to what's best for the people of North Dakota. What's best for the mission at hand, and how do we relate that not to our political party or our political philosophy, but what happens to the people? Because as Heidi mentioned, we are a people-driven government and should be. A couple of lessons I learned along the way. After this difficult, I wasn't supposed to win either, by the way. And she talked about 22 points down. After the primary in North Dakota in June, I was 22 points in the hole against my opponent. gave him a lot of false security, but I was running for office, and the thing that was important to me at the time was, how are you going to perform? How are you going to get the job done? It wasn't a fun time. Politicians are pretty competitive. Things were negative. The better I did, the worse it got on the other side. But you know what? The first person who called me after the election, after I was elected, the first person who called me was a person who had written letters to the editor about how bad I was, how awful I was, and if I would get elected, the state would go down the tubes. It was Governor Art Link. And Governor Art Link called me first thing, and if you knew Art Link, it was 6 o'clock in the morning. I think I just went to bed, actually. You know, his comment was, look, it wasn't advice about how to run the state or what to do. He said, just stay with who you are. Stand for who you are. Don't get sidetracked by headlines or polls or letters to the editor or your opposition or special interest groups. Be true to who you are and govern the best way you can for the good of the people. Really solid advice. Keeping that in mind after the election, and Heidi and I ended up on the Industrial Commission in the state of North Dakota, which is a pretty powerful government board. You know, we didn't have to represent our parties anymore. We had to represent the people of North Dakota and the Bank of North Dakota and the state mill and other important institutions, the oil and gas development and things in the state of North Dakota. So our mission was, how do we do this together? How do we get this done? And that changed the relationship out of the rancor, the politics, into the performance aspect of being there. We were both reelected in those jobs, and Heidi talked about when she first ran for Senate, you know, that things were different politically, but I'm convinced when Heidi wasn't supposed to win, she won because of her performance. She won because she did the job. She won because people understood that she cared about the government, that she directed good government, and she delivered good government for the people of North Dakota. That's why she won, not because of all the political money and the, you know, changes. I mean, it was the performance of the people. And if you keep in mind the people, I think you can stay away from the political rancor that takes place all the time. Now, let me give you another example that I have that I think is hugely important about Republicans and Democrats working together. In 2008, when I was Secretary of Agriculture, the World Food Prize is given annually to someone who has been hugely influential globally in nutrition or in agriculture. In 2008, the World Food Prize was given to two people, Senator Bob Dole and Senator George McGovern, together. The interesting thing was, you know, strong Democrats, strong Republican, both well-known nationally, both strong leaders, but they were given this World Food Prize because of the work they did for nutrition for kids, because they championed not only changes in nutrition programs and WIC programs and food programs for kids in North Dakota, school lunches and school breakfasts, after school programs, they championed, but they did globally. And they talked about how, you know, when hungry kids don't learn. You know, we need in these foreign countries to put programs together to feed people, to get them into school, to get them learning, to get them educated, and how important that was. But the most important thing to me in that ceremony was when the two of them were called up to the stage to accept the award. They stood at the podium, and the first thing they did was sing "Jesus Loves the Little Children." They accepted the award, they went back down, and of course the Democrats were sitting on one side of the chambers, the Republicans were sitting on the other side of the chambers, but when all the applause was done, everything was quieted, they reached across the aisle and they held hands. That is what leadership is all about. And so that's been inspiring to me ever since about the way that we deal with people, the way that we try to forge public policy for the good of everyone, not just the political party or whatever. Because, and we all can kind of take this stuff too seriously. You know, I mean, it's a good idea to be humble out there, to say, well, we have a job to do, but, you know, the end of the world isn't going to be there if I don't get my job done, or if I don't get elected or whatever. We have a strong system. It's resilient. It's capable. And it can be driven forward in a good and happy manner.
As we listen to these narratives, it's clear that both Senator Heitkamp and Governor Schaefer not only advocate for bridging political divides, but also live by those principles. Their stories and insights from this event at Concordia College underscore a vital message for all of us. In the face of division, civility, respect, and a focus on the common good can pave the way for a more united and productive society. In times of division, let us remember the power of civility, the importance of dialogue, and the unyielding potential of collective action towards the common good.
Hi, I'm Dave Thompson. My e-newsletter, Do You Know Dak, is for political junkies and those who don't know they are yet. Subscribe at PrairiePublic.org and I'll get you wise to everything that's percolating in Bismarck that might impact your life. I'll also give you context for my 40-something years of covering news and politics in North Dakota. And boy, have I got some stories. Do You Know Dak? A fun, informative gateway to the news you should know.
This is Dakota Daybook for July 29th. Ponies diving from great heights into water, a log rolling contest, performances by big brass bands and performers leaping the fiery gap were among the numerous attractions that drew an estimated crowd of 10,000 people to the first day of the Fargo Interstate Fair on this date in 1907. The Interstate Fair was one of many oftentimes competing state fairs held throughout North Dakota prior to the State Fair, making its permanent home in Minot with the creation of the State Fair Association in 1965. However, these varied events were outshone when famed auto racer Barney Oldfield took to the track at the fair in his peerless Green Dragon racing car. One of the foremost celebrities of his day, Oldfield was known for such feats as becoming the first American to drive a gasoline-powered automobile at speeds of a mile per minute on a dirt track in 1903, and becoming Speed King of the World when he powered a Blitzen Benz to over 131 miles per hour on Daytona Beach in 1910. There was certainly excitement to see the great racing driver on what was both Automobile Day and Children's Day at the fair, as the auto races were well attended and generated more interest than the fair's horse races. Alongside other automobile races held that Monday, Oldfield raced in exhibition and handicap races against local drivers and raced against the clock in timed events on the half-mile track. The Hatton Free Press reported that all there was to see was a cloud of dust when Oldfield's Green Dragon hit the track, completing the first mile of a 3-mile race in 1 minute 15 and a half seconds, breaking his own world record for that distance. The record breaking continued when he took the checkered flag of the 3-mile race in 3 minutes and 51 seconds, 18 seconds better than the record he'd set earlier that month in Winnipeg. Though Oldfield's record-breaking speed, averaging about 47 miles per hour, is unimpressive by today's standards, back in 1907 it was, by all accounts, a thrilling event to remember for that day's fairgoers in Fargo. Today's Dakota Daybook, written by Matt Eli. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Daybook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll visit with Fulbright Scholarship winner, Dr. Ali Alshami from the University of North Dakota, and we hope you can join us again on Main Street.